You are listening to the Cycling Podcast in association with Rafa, the fastest clothing in the world tour, the home of cycling with character. Ride and watch with Rafa in 2019 as they partner EF Education First and Canyon SRAM.
Hello, my name's Richard Moore and I'm with Lionel Burney.
Hello, Richard.
And we're going to be virtually joined by somebody else in a moment. This is a special episode of the Cycling Podcast.
Yeah, it's the first of 6 weekly episodes, which will take us right through the Spring Classics series, in which Adam Blythe, who rides for Lotto Soudal, of course, interviews some of his fellow professional riders.
That's right. There have been 2 catalysts for this introduction of this little series, this mini-series. First one was an interview with Adam that we released towards the end of last year, which had a really great response from our listeners, and also Adam's enthusiasm for podcasting. He came to us and expressed a desire to try his hand on the other side of the fence, so to speak, as interviewer rather than interviewee.
Indeed. Well, if you're wondering who Adam Blythe is, I'm sure the name is familiar to you, but he rides now for Lotto Soudal. He actually started his career with the same team when they were Omega Pharma Lotto back in 2010. He's since ridden for BMC Racing, Orica Green Edge, Tinkoff, Aqua Blue Sport, which perhaps won't want to dwell on too much, and now back with Lotto Soudal. Former national champion, Great Britain national champion. He won the London Surrey Classic in 2014 when he rode for the small NFTO team. And can count among former teammates Philippe Gilbert, Alberto Contador, Peter Sagan, and a current teammate is his first interview subject in this episode, the Lotto Soudal sprinter Caleb Ewan. We thought it would be a good one to kick off the series with, particularly because we're all looking ahead to Milan Sanremo, where Ewan was second last year.
Before we pass over to Adam, we must say a big thanks to our headline sponsor, Rafa, and tell you that coming on the 22nd of March are the new Rafa shoes, featuring the classic and explorer designs, both tested over tens of thousands of kilometres. And the classic shoe has already been raced in the World Tour by riders from EF Education First. They have full carbon soles coated in an incredibly thin and light no-slip hard-wearing rubber for when you're off the bike. And they have Rafa's double wall lacing to provide a more comfortable and secure fit. To check out the new Rafa shoes, there's more at rafa.cc.
Before we join Adam and Caleb, just a little parental warning. There is a bit of language that may not be suitable for young or sensitive ears.
You are listening to a special episode of the Cycling Podcast. Adam Blythe interviews.
Right, we're on. So, first podcast, first guest here, Caleb Ewan. We're here in training camp, Lotto Soudal, first one. Sat at the back of a bar. Moment, I've got a glass of red. Caleb's got a decaf coffee because he had a few too many glasses of red the other night. How are you finding it, mate?
Yeah, it's been good so far. Lots of training, lots of meetings, lots of photo shoots. But yeah, it's good to get it all done in the kind of a week and a half, and then we don't have to worry about it for the rest of the year. But yeah, it's been pretty busy. Obviously getting to know everyone as well.
Same. Remembering names, mate. How hard is it?
Oh, it's so hard, especially when most of the, well, actually, yeah, pretty much all the names are Belgian. The whole, I think everyone in the staff is Belgian besides one soigneur who's Spanish, and the rest of Belgium. So just remembering names they've never heard before is it's pretty difficult, yeah.
Yeah, it's not easy. I think I can remember like 7 guys' names. The way I remember them is off Instagram. They'll follow me on Instagram. I'm like, oh yeah, this guy, I know him now. That's it. So, kick off this podcast with how you got into cycling, really, and was there anything in the family about it? And you used to do track as well. I didn't really know this until I joined Orica, but yeah, how long did you do track for before you got on the road, or was it vice versa?
No, well, I did, like, when you're like, pretty much all Australian riders will do track and road growing up, like all through the junior ranks, like under 13s, 15s, 17s, whatever. So I was just doing that. It's like track in the summer and road in the winter. So yeah, I did that. When I started, when I was 10, my first race was on a mountain bike on the track. So yeah, that's a good combo. So yeah, I did that. And then yeah, just growing up, I was always track and road. Then I peaked in my track career when I was first year junior, and I won Junior Worlds Omnium. And then after that, I pretty much switched the road.
You won Junior Worlds Omnium?
Yeah.
Shit, I didn't know that. Bloody hell.
Yeah, I won when I was a first year. I was always had my heart set on the road, because that's just road, yeah. And then I made the track team, and they told me that I could actually do track and road. So I was like, oh, perfect, because I actually want to do the road. But if I can do track and road, then it's good. And it was a sprint as well. It was in Denmark that year for the road. And then so then I was preparing for the selection races for the national road team. I won the selection race, which pretty much if you win a selection race, then you get selected, because there's only like 4 selection races. Anyway, I won the selection race. It was a 7K climb to the finish, and I won solo. And then after that, they decided to change the rules that they would only take second years to both track and road. So then I was left on the track, and I couldn't go do the road race, which I was really pissed about. But anyway, I guess in the end I made the most of it, and I won a world title, so I can't complain. But then after that, I was pretty annoyed about that whole situation. So the next year, I didn't go back to the track. I just went all the way to the road, and then that's kind of how my track career ended.
Damn, there's a lot gone on quickly. Holy shit. I didn't know you were a bloody Omnium champion. Do you ever think about going back or not, or are you just solely stuck on the road? Because obviously, Tokyo, mate, it's quite illy. It's not on the track, though.
Yeah, I always think about getting back on, but not to the extent of going to the Olympics. Definitely not the next Olympics. Maybe the Olympics after. I always think about it, but I just know that it's so hard to get into the Australian team for the track, because their number one priority is team pursuit. And actually, that's another reason why I stopped on the track as well, because I had no future really in the Australian team, because I'm too small. Everyone, when I was at Junior Worlds Camp, everyone was complaining about sitting on me. So it's like, if you're not a team pursuer, then you can't really make it as an Australian on the track. Even the Omnium or Madison riders are guys that can step into the team pursuit and still do well there.
It's true, but it's coming back in slowly. Madison's back in the Olympics now, so you never know. You mentioned Ghent while you've been on this climb. A lot of Belgian guys here did Ghent while they were there. Jasper de Bust, Tosh van der Sander. You mentioned doing it. You got your eyes set on that next year. And why aren't you asked to do it with me?
Do it with you?
Yeah.
Yeah, well, Lotto's the main sponsor, so I'm sure they wouldn't mind us doing it. But yeah, actually, I'd love to go and race a race like Ghent, just because there's so much history behind it, and that'd be a cool one at the end of the career to say, yeah, I won it. Or
yeah.
So I wouldn't want to just go. I would want to go and actually have a crack at winning it. But yeah, I'd love to go do something like that. It's not too serious, it's not like trying to go for the Olympics or World Cups or World Championships. It's something maybe a bit more fun and something that you don't have to prepare too much for.
Yeah, I'd say so. But if you do ask Jasper about it, he's like, oh, you have to prepare it. It's not easy. But you have got a good selection. You've got Roger here, who's done it. I think he might have won it, actually. Jasper's been second and third. Tosh.
No, he's won it twice. Yeah, Jasper's won it twice.
Who is?
I don't know. He just told me the other day that he's won it twice.
Wow, I didn't know that. Bloody hell, he is good, isn't he?
Yeah.
Damn.
I said to him, if we do it together, we make sure we win. He's like, oh, I don't care, I've won it twice already. I'm like, yeah, what about me?
There you go then, mate. Selection made. I'm your man. Brilliant. Wow, well, I didn't know you did that much track, to be honest. And, like, looking at it now, were you happy that you did the track? Did you learn a lot from it? Because when I was doing it, when I was growing up, I learned a lot from doing the track, like where to hide and all that kind of stuff. And obviously, I didn't know you did all that. But, yeah, you think it helps you? Like, if you're looking at a young guy now, growing up, a young you, would you look back and be like, yeah, it was a good idea? Or, I wish I'd have stuck to the road more.
Yeah, I reckon it was a really good idea. Like you said, you learn so much from it, just positioning yourself and learning how to run at a wheel and all that kind of stuff. And I reckon I learned, especially a lot early on in my cycling career, like when I was, I don't know, in between maybe 13 and 16 where it was really like half the guys you were racing had hit puberty and the other half hadn't. So it was like half the 15 year olds are like men and then the other half are still like 10 year olds. And I was one of those guys that was like a 10 year old racing against men. And it was just like, I had no chance of winning. There's guys that just get on the front like five laps to go and they just sit there and just like get faster and faster and faster. No one come around and they never had to think about how to win. They just got on the front and then they just won. Whereas I think I learned a lot because I didn't have the strength back then to sit on the front for five laps and win a race. I had to really think about where I was positioned and all that kind of stuff. So I think I did learn a lot like when I was racing on the track, and it's probably still some of that stuff that you use now even in the World Tour races.
Yeah, I'd say so. It's amazing, you'll agree with me probably, that if you watch like guys in a break or something like that that are in a small group and they're not really someone that gets a massive chance all the time, they come into a sprint and you're like, what are you doing? Why aren't you laying off the wheel and that kind of stuff? But it's quite obvious they've just been brought up purely on the road by their power. Don't have any clue about tactics and all that stuff. So yeah, it's pretty I'd say it's valuable to a young guy, as you just said, really. So moving on, once you did the road race, I think, where you were second in the world when you were under 23.
So when I was a first year junior, I won worlds on the track. Yeah. And then the second year I scrapped the track and went on the road, and that was in Valkenburg, the junior worlds. That year Mahorik won. He attacked over the top of he attacked over the Kalberg, and I was away with three guys on the Kalberg. Then we got caught and he attacked and I was dead, and I was like, it's only a K and a half to the finish. So then we were just kind of like preparing for the bunch sprint. So he went, there was big hesitation, he won, and then I won the bunch kick. So then I was just like, then I was second, which is probably the worst place to come.
It's like the nationals.
Yeah, so it's just like second place there, so I just missed out on being a world champion there. And then the next year, as an under 23, the race wasn't, it was in Florence, so it was a pretty hilly race.
Yeah.
Not really to my characteristics. But back then I was actually climbing a lot better than I, well, maybe not a lot better, but I was climbing
good.
Yeah, pretty good.
Yeah.
That time, Mahorik won again as a first year 23. He was also away, I think he was away solo. And we're coming out, I don't know if you remember the Florence Worlds, there was a real steep climb, like 5k from the finish. So I'd gotten over all the climbs around the last lap. They were away probably 30 seconds in front, him and Menchies, I think, the South African.
Louis Menchies.
They were away, and I attacked on the steep bit, and I rode Simon off the wheel. A claim to fame for me. Rode Simon off the wheel. The commentators were saying something about a Colombian coming up the hill. So I'm going to take that as a compliment anyway. And then I was kind of like in the middle of the bunch of 10 or 15 guys. I can't remember how many guys were in the bunch. And the break, I think I was only 5 seconds off Lewis.
Yeah.
I was 5 seconds off Lewis, and I was kind of in that no man's land. I was absolutely pinned because I'd gone full gas, and it was at the end of the race, and I was like, all right, I'm not gonna keep going full gas and then get caught by the bunch. So I was like, the bunch is just here. So I'll sit up, and then those two stayed away, and then from the bunch there was an American that attacked in the last K. And no one, like, they all, obviously all knew I was a sprinter, and no one chased that American. I had no teammates left, and I was like, oh shit. And then I started sprinting with 500 meters to go.
Oh.
And then I was rolled on the line by a Norwegian. So then that's the next, the next worst place to come in a world championship or a championship race is fourth.
Fourth.
So I was just off the podium. And then the next year was Ponferrada, so it really wasn't suited to me either. Anyway, a Norwegian got away, same story. I was in the bunch, won the bunch kick, and I got second. So I think, like, pretty much all the world championships that I've done, I've just been, like, in the worst positions you can be. Besides, is it Doha?
Yeah.
Yeah, then I just got dropped and didn't finish.
Oh, dear. And in between all this, like, all the worlds and everything, you moved to Italy, I think, if I'm right. You moved when you were first year and 23?
Yeah, so I was in the Australian Institute of Sport, and they had their base in Italy. So I did 1 year at the base, and then I did another year just living on my own in a place called Varese.
How was that? Living on your own? How old were you?
Oh, must have been... I was like 19 or... Yeah, it must have been 19.
Damn. So living on your own, 19, in Europe, away from home. Obviously, you're missing home a lot. And then after that, what happened? Because you obviously spent 2 years, I think, as an amateur, and then you went professional after that, and that's where we met.
Yeah, so I signed my contract as a first year under 23, and the contract started the next year in October, so I could do Tour of Beijing, which was a world tour race.
And is it right that I heard as well, I've got it written down here on one of my notes, my great notes thing that I've written down, is that when you were young you had quite a lot of teams after you, so when you were junior a lot of teams were looking at you, and I heard that Sky give you a bike that you've still got actually.
Yeah, so there was like a little bit of interest in me after I had won a few of the Bay Crits. Because at the time I was 17 and I was racing like McEwen and Alan Davis and all these guys that are, yeah, good sprinters, pro and good sprinters. And now I understand, now that I'm pro, that you go to a race like that and you're not, yeah, I mean, you're not completely motivated. I'm not as motivated going to a Bay Crit now than I was when I was 17. Like back then you really had a point to prove, whereas now... Yeah. Now I actually fear that happening to me. So that's actually giving me like a little bit more motivation to actually go there and do well. But yeah. Anyway, I had a few teams that maybe wanted to sign me in the future. And Sky was one of them. And then, yeah, they were helping me a bit as a... Like when I was a second year junior. Because I'd come to Europe again with one of my friends from Australia, and we were like traveling around together racing. And Sky had given me a bike, and at the time an SRM, which was pretty cool when you're 17 to have an SRM. And they had one guy of the team, Bobby Julik, that was like analyzing my data and stuff. So at the time, yeah, when you're a teenager and you have a team like that kind of monitoring you, I think it's great.
Yeah, I could imagine. I don't think many teams now, even when you're at that age, they probably wouldn't think, like a lot of teams now probably wouldn't monitor you as well as Sky were doing back then, really. I don't know if they have done until then, like with Orica and everything, but what they do is pretty special. I think if you're in that situation, you know you're going to, it's not you know you're going to do well, is it? But if you've got Sky watching your back, you're almost like, yeah, I'm gonna do good here, sort of thing.
Well, yeah, it's not that, oh yeah, I'm gonna do well, but it's kind of when I first realized, like, shit, I can be a professional.
Yeah.
Because up until then, especially as an Australian, it's like being a pro rider is such a far off thing. Like you never see pro races in Australia. You just watch the Tour de France on TV, and that's in France, like on the other side of the world, and it just doesn't cross your mind. You're just doing cycling as a sport. Yeah. And then that was kind of like a foot in the door and a realization that, yeah, you can have a career out of it. And with that bike as well, I did still have it. My brother had it, and then it was stolen. He actually messaged me this year and was like, oh, yeah. Well, he actually asked me for another bike. I was like, what happened to the one that you had? He's like, yeah, it was stolen.
Interestingly though, the bike was a Specialized, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was a Specialized. So I don't know what the deal was there. But anyway, I heard like, this was the same year Cav went to the team. Okay. And I heard that maybe like there was Specialized was going to go there or yeah. I don't know. Anyway, I ended up with the Specialized and I was happy with it anyways. Had like electronic gears and all that stuff and SRM.
Living the dream as a junior.
Shoot à l'arrière du peloton. Cycling podcast team car at the back of the pack, please.
That's the voice of Seb Piquet, race radio at the Tour de France, to remind us to tell you that this episode of the Cycling Podcast is sponsored by DNA Fit, who provide genetically guided fitness and nutrition insights for training solutions and long-term health benefits. DNA Fit has helped 50,000 people unlock their health potential through genetically personalized fitness and nutrition insights. Actually, make that 50,001, because Richard, you sent off a sample of your DNA to be analysed and I presume help you with your training solutions.
Absolutely, Lionel.
Well, what did that involve?
Well, we'll tell this story in five parts, and the first part involves collecting and sending away a sample of your DNA, which I found very simple. You're sent a pack containing a swab in what looks like a test tube with a small quantity of blue liquid. You unscrew it, stick the swab in your mouth, rub it against your gums, screw it back into the test tube, soak it in the blue liquid, stick it in the provided envelope, and Bob's your uncle.
Bob's your uncle? Is that what the DNA test has told you so far?
Yeah, very good. No, you get the results back in 10 days. This is assuming that I did all these bits that I've just mentioned correctly. And then you have a phone call with a consultant. The idea is that genetically matched meal and exercise plans help you, as DNA Fit puts it, determine fact from fiction when it comes to fad diets or trendy exercises. It's about giving you the tools to train well, if that's what you're doing, or to eat healthily, if health is your main concern, as it is for me.
Yeah, I was going to ask, what are you training for?
I'm not training for anything, but we're no longer young men, Lionel, and at our sort of age, you start to worry a bit about your health. Don't you? I do.
Well, I'm trying not to. DNA Fit has robust science behind it. Every gene they look at has at least 3 peer-reviewed studies on human subjects. And in 2016, they released the world's first genetic exercise intervention-based study, showing that you can discover what kind of exercise works best for you.
Well, in the next installment, I'm going to report back on my results, which I'm kind of apprehensively waiting for at the moment. It's a nervous time. I'm sure that I'm as curious as you, Lionel, are, and the listeners.
I can't wait.
Sure, everybody's.
Well, I can't wait to see what they tell you.
My results.
DNA Fit are offering 20% off to all of our listeners. So start your personalized health journey today by heading to dnafit.com/TCP to access the discount code and discover more. That's dnafit.com/TCP.
You are listening to a special episode of the Cycling Podcast. Adam Blythe interviews.
So then after all with the Sky stuff, how did Orica come around? And did you have choices on your, when you were looking at being a pro? You obviously had an agent or someone sort of advising you, and you had Sky looking at you. I don't know if they offered you a contract or not, but do you look back and think, yeah, this was a wise decision? Or did you go, oh, damn, I wish I'd have gone to another team? I don't know if anyone offered you or not, but... Yeah.
At the time I was signing, my first offer was from Green Edge.
Yeah.
And that was in May, my first year under 23s. So I'd just been under 23s for a few months. And I'd won my first big race in Italy. I'd won a Nations Cup race. So I'd started really well, and then I got a contract from an offer from Green Edge, and then my manager started talking to some other teams, and BMC was another one that I was talking to, and then we were speaking with Sky, and then in the end, because I wanted to stay under 23s another year, and I wouldn't have been able to sign a pre-contract with Sky and stayed in my under 23 program. BMC already had an under 23 program that I could have gone to also, so that was an option.
Yeah.
And then obviously staying where I was an option, because then I go from there to Green Edge. I think maybe I was speaking to AG2R as well, which is a bit random. Yeah,
very random. Properly random. It's good though, so I have all them teams now. Yeah. And when you signed this contract, did you have as many teams asking for you? We'll get back to like the Orica minute in a minute. It's just nice to talk about cash.
Wait, which this contract that I'm on now?
Yeah, so did you, when you were negotiating this, was there other teams interested in approaching you?
Well, no, this has probably been the first contract is really important, because you want to start your career right. But I think this one would be equally or more important for my career, because if your career doesn't really step up now, then, like, for me, if it didn't step up now and I had an average next few years, then my career can really go downhill. Yeah. So it was actually something that I had to think about for a long time, and I was with my agent and we spoke a lot about the different teams that we could go to and all that kind of stuff. We had spoken to Lotto and they were interested. And in the end, we didn't really bother going around to all the other teams and ask them if they were interested or anything, because this is the one that we wanted, and we just put our effort into making this deal happen, and it was kind of like, I think Andre was kind of coming to the end of his career and I'm kind of just starting, and I think they wanted maybe a renewal in the team a little bit, and it kind of was just like perfect timing. Both our contracts were ending, and originally they said they wanted to keep Andre, which was fine with me, and I would have liked to have learnt from a guy like him as well, so I was pretty happy with when they said that they were also going to keep him. But then, in the end, I mean, it was out of my control, but I don't know the fine details of what happened between him and the team, but he obviously didn't end up staying.
It's probably just threatened that he had a little young gun like you, mate, coming in to take your place. But was the reason signing for this team as well, obviously you want to do the Tour de France, it's not a secret about that, and obviously with Orica and the way they were going with the Yates brothers, that was all so based on GC these days. So was that the main reason that you wanted to leave? Because obviously what happened this year before the Tour, you told me earlier in the week that they rung you a week before the race, which is, it's never nice before any race, especially before the Tour. So, I mean, it's obviously a big part in why you signed here, that you've got all this focus around you and basically the whole team here to get you through that Tour and get you a stage win, really.
Yeah, I think with obviously the Yates and Esteban and even some of the young Australians coming through as well, they've got so many GC options, and it's obvious, like, that's the direction they're going. In the end, if I have a team that's going to say or is offering to let me do the races I want to do with a full team support around me, or my other option is staying where I am and maybe having a split team, like half the team to help me and half a GC, or me going to a race by myself because our main focus is GC, it's really kind of an easy decision.
And you had to do that a lot. You told me earlier in the week that you had to go a lot of races alone, and you obviously had Roger in the team and you were separated a lot, and it's obviously not for you or for any team, really. If you look back on it, you're like, flipping heck. Looking back, you're one of the best sprinters in the world now. The sprint's changing so much, but you are one of the best sprinters, and if a team can't back you that much, then it's obviously something going wrong. Not wrong, but the focus is otherwise. And did you feel that, like, early on in the year when it was all changing so much?
I mean, I think as a sprinter you want real, like, consistency in your train. You don't want one guy coming in and then you do another race and another guy comes in, and you want to, because the better bond you have with your train, the better it all works together and the more you guys learn together. And a lot of the time my train was changing, but I can't say that they took me to every race and didn't have support for me. Like, a lot of the races they did have a fair few guys for me, and but it was really the big ones, the main ones, that I was lacking the support, and they're the ones that you really need the support. If I go to Down Under or Tour of California, I've got guys, like, almost the whole team for me. But then when you step into the Tour, where you really need a whole team, then the team just split, or the Giro, the team split, or even San Remo there. It's not like, I think I proved to the team the year before that I could go for a good result, and then that year, so 2 years ago, they didn't back me for obviously anything. They luckily, credit them, they let me do my own thing, and I ended up top 10. I can't remember what I ended up actually getting, but it was top 10. And then I beat the riders in the team that was supported. So then I thought maybe the next year, I told them that it was definitely going to be one of my targets for the year, and I was hoping that they'd give me full support, which they did give me a lot of support. But then in the crucial moment when I need the support really the most, it was like two of the main guys that could really help me were allowed to go and attack in moves and everything up the Poggio, which obviously doesn't help me as a sprinter. And then they basically said, oh, if you get to the top of the Poggio, which I proved the year before I can do, they said, all right, then we'll give you those guys that were allowed to go in moves, then they can help you. And then in the end, I got over the Poggio in good position and everything, and I was ready to do my sprint. And Nibali was away, and Trenton was supposed to... if I got to the top of the Poggio, everyone was there in the team, was there to help me then in the sprint. And then in the end... Yeah, Trenton tried to attack by himself in the final, in the downhill, and then I ended up missing out on San Remo by about 10 meters. Stuff like that kind of like builds up over 4 years. Little things like that build up, and then in the end, when a team comes to you and says, "Oh, we'll give you full support in all the races that you want," then you don't really have to think twice about it.
Yeah, it's true. Bloody hell, I didn't know all that about San Remo. It's in depth, isn't it? But yeah, it's sad, really, that especially after the year you had before, it didn't give you that much support. And, like, you came so close this year. Maybe we'll win it this year, mate. Hopefully. And is that obviously just one of your goals that you want to win next year? You've got, obviously, the tour you want to go well in. You spoke a little bit about doing the Giro as well. I'm not sure if you're going to do that or not yet. But San Remo, the tour... Down Under we go to in a month. So have you got any other races that you'd like to, it's not win, but go to and be competitive in to learn for the future? Or obviously it's a Belgian team, so you might have to get stuck into a few classics or something. But is there any race you've got your eye on not to win, like maybe just doing Paris-Roubaix or something like that? And then the races you want to win as well, which probably is a fairly obvious question, but we'll ask it anyway.
Well, at the moment I'm not doing any classics.
That's what you think.
Yeah. Well, we'll see about that. But the difference, I guess, if I can say a main difference between Mitchelton and this team is last year I didn't do a grand tour at all, which I feel like I didn't deserve. Like, I've won at the time I was... I'd won by the time I was 22... a stage in the Vuelta and Giro, so I think I at least deserve a start in the Giro or Vuelta. I think I deserve a start in the Tour, but they obviously didn't think so. But then I've come into this team and we've spoken about race program and all that kind of stuff, and I told them that I would be pretty keen to do Giro and Tour, and and then they said if you want to do that then you can do it. So that's the difference in a team that really has faith in you compared to, a team that didn't have... I don't know if they didn't have faith, but, that can ruin your season like that.
Yeah, for sure. It's just I guess that they've got other ambitions with the Yates brothers as well, stepping up so much. I guess they saw, which they did in the end, Simon won the Vuelta. They probably thought they had a really good chance in the Tour, but it's just a shame that they didn't take you. Did they give you a reason?
Oh, no, they said it was based on performance. They said I wasn't going good enough. They said I hadn't had a good enough season yet. Which, to be fair, I hadn't had a season like I had the year before. But I mean, I was almost won San Remo. Like, if the race had gone a little bit differently, I could have won San Remo, which really makes the season. It can make a career, winning a race like that. And I think I was second there as a 23-year-old, which I think is a decent achievement and a decent proving, I guess, that I was ready to race big races. And I'd won a stage in Giro and Vuelta also. So I think I'd like proved myself really up until that point. And, you know, if I knew I was fighting for selection, which I didn't know I was fighting for any selection because they had told me I was definitely doing it, then I would have approached the races in between San Remo and the Tour differently. I only had Tour of California and Tour of Slovenia between San Remo and the Tour, so not many races at all. And in that time, I was meant to prove myself, I guess. But I didn't know I was supposed to prove myself. And I don't want to come up with all excuses about not winning. Yeah, maybe I should have won a race in those races, but I hadn't raced in 2 months, and I came straight down from an altitude camp into California, and I think I podiumed five out of the 7 days. So that was my start.
The crazy thing with that, though, is that you podium in them races, and if you look at the Tour now, like looking back on it, obviously you can't look at it then because it's in the future, but Gaviria, you're beating every day. Well, not every day, but most of the days. Sagan, you're beating every day in the sprints, and those guys are like consistently 1-2 in the Tour every day, 1-2-3-4, you know, top five every day consistently. And if you're looking at that, surely that team's got to look at you and be like, bloody hell, he's flying, you know. And this is still quite, it's not a miles out, but it's far enough for you to do something in the Tour where you can still build on what you've already got. You know, you came, as you said, you came straight down from altitude into this, so you're not going to be fresh from a camp for number one. So it's quite, even I'm disappointed now and I'm not even in your team.
Yeah, so like after California, I was pretty happy with like where I was at, my first race back after 2 months of not racing and from an altitude camp. So then my second one was Slovenia, which there was two sprints at the start, and I think I was informed to win a sprint. The first stage was a sprint and the second stage was a sprint. The first stage, I crashed at a K to go. So obviously I couldn't win that sprint because I crashed at a K to go. And when you crash like hard at high speed, like we're going 60K an hour and I crashed, so it was a decent fall. You get up the next day and you're not feeling 100%. Like
yeah.
Everything's sore and like you've just hit the ground at 60K an hour. Obviously not feeling great. The second day, I crashed again on one of the descents. I was going around a hairpin and crashed like 30K to go. So I was just really like, oh, I don't know. I was sore and I was angry. Anyway, that stage, I got third. So it wasn't too bad. I finished that tour, went home and I was starting to prepare again. And my coach was flying over from Australia to do my last preparation for the tour. And actually, as he landed and like turned on his phone, then it was like announced. So he turned on his phone to messages or whatever saying that I wasn't doing the tour. He's traveled all the way from Australia. The team knew he was coming all the way from Australia. I said to them, like, you knew my coach was coming. Why didn't you just say something before? So like save him coming all the way from Europe. He came with his daughter as well. So like they both traveled all the way from Australia. And they're like, oh yeah, we just decided like today. Bullshit, you didn't just decide today. Because one of the other coaches of the team asked me if my coach was still coming over like a couple of days before, and I said yeah he's still coming. So they knew. And I, to be honest, I had a meeting with some of the staff in Slovenia, and I kind of got like a bad vibe from it. They started talking a lot about GC. They didn't say to me, no, you're not going, but they're really emphasizing how good Adam's going and blah blah blah. And yeah, he was going good. He won a stage in Dauphiné, so yeah, he was going really good. And they really were talking about how, and I was just like, why are you telling me like how good he's going? So to be honest, when they actually said to me that I wasn't doing it, I was a little bit prepared for it, because they were just acting it weird. Like, they're usually really positive with me, and then now they're trying to bring up, like, when I was meeting with them, they'll bring up past results, like, oh, you haven't won for a while, but so it's kind of like, yeah, they have, in hindsight, I reckon they've made their mind up much earlier, and I think they could have given at least my coach the courtesy of saying, don't bother coming.
It's a shame, really. it's a proper shame. It's cycling the world it is. It doesn't happen. Well, it happens quite a lot, but you don't really hear about it in such a scenario like that, really. But yeah, would have probably done you better to be in like 20th in that stage in Slovenia, so you can be like, no, I'm knackered, I've not had a good day, rather than fight on, still get a decent result, getting third, but then not really doing much after it, really. Yeah, anyway, moving on from those dark days, looking forward to the future now with me. So mate, you are 24 now, quite a lot going on in your life. You've got a G-Wagon, you've got a Porsche, you've got a million watches, you're married, and you've got a pretty special announcement. I'll let you tell the world what it is.
Yeah, so I think more importantly than all that stuff, I'm going to have a baby in July. I'm not going to have a baby, actually. My wife will have a baby, yeah. So yeah, I'm going to become a dad, so that's going to change a lot. Probably won't be buying cars and stuff anymore. Or if I am, probably mum vans or something. But yeah, so I guess that's in my personal life, that's obviously probably a big thing that's happening and something that's going to change a lot, I guess. Hopefully it doesn't affect my performance on the bike, but we'll see.
Nah, it won't, mate. It'll be good. You're part of a nice club now, mate. You can chat about baby things at the back of the peloton with me and Swift and Stannard and those guys. But no, so in your cycling career, obviously it's amazing news. Congratulations, by the way. I've said it already, but where you're at now in your career, are you satisfied with where you are, and you're looking forward to where you're going to be, but your goals for 2019, are they obviously a tour is the big one, but any other goals along the way that you really want to achieve, or anything you want to achieve personally along the way, anything you want to get better at? Or
I'm pretty happy with my physical progression since I turned pro. Results wise, could be better. Definitely this 2018 was like a plateau in my short career so far, so I'm hoping that will step up again. But yeah, I mean, I could take a lot away from 2018. The years before, I think I was always stepping up, improving and winning better races and getting better at the races that I wouldn't have been able to win before. So yeah, I think everything's pretty well on track, and now I'm in a team that kind of specializes in classics and sprints, which are the races that I want to focus on. So my ambitions and the team ambitions really line up well, so I'm hoping this year could be much better, and I think I'm going to try to do the Giro and the Tour, which will be a lot. I think if I do all the races that I've planned to do, I'm going to have 80 plus race days, which I'm definitely not used to. I think 2018 I had 50 race days maybe around that, so it's going to be a lot in that sense to do that many more race days. But I think it's something that I need to do in my career probably now. I haven't finished a Grand Tour yet, so that's something that I'm going to definitely try to do this year. And having a season like that with 80 or 85 race days, I think your body will really change, and I'll become, I don't know, a bit better at all the endurance kind of stuff. And yeah, I hope that kind of makes me another like step stronger.
Hey, that beach body will be gone, mate, if you do them all them race days. You'll be like skinny and lean and everything. Good. So Tour de France stages, San Remo, Giro stages, that's what I'm expecting from you, because hopefully I'll be there with you doing it. That'll be the main aim for me as well. Yeah, that's pretty much it, mate. I don't think we've got anything else to really chat about apart from that's it. So thanks for coming, mate. Thanks for doing this first one with me. Hopefully this goes down all right. Richard, if you let me know how this goes, please, mate. And thanks everyone for coming. Do you want to say thanks?
Thanks.
See you later, guys.
The Cycling Podcast is supported by Science in Sport. Science in Sport, fueled by science.
Thank you very much to Science in Sport for their support of the Cycling Podcast and all that we do all year round. Their support is very much appreciated. And they also support you, the listener, by offering a 25% off discount. Go to scienceandsport.com, enter the code SISCP25 at the checkout. That doesn't work in conjunction with any other offers, but SISCP25 will get you 25% off all your sports nutrition products at scienceandsport.com. We should say thanks to Adam Blythe as well. We just heard the first of his interviews with fellow writers. Caleb Ewan was first up, and I learned a lot about Caleb Ewan from his chat. He's not a writer I know a great deal about anyway, but you know, hearing about his past performances in races like the under 23 World Championships in Florence, for example, which was a pretty testing course, won by Matej Mohoric, who's also doing well now. But what came through in understanding a bit more of his history was how much of a versatile rider he was before. As a professional, he's become more sort of pigeonholed as a bunch sprinter. But we saw recently at the UAE Tour that Caleb Ewan is perhaps more than a bunch sprinter. And we saw at Milan-San Remo last year that he can challenge in races like that too.
Yeah, I think the thing that stood out to me was Adam's interview style, which was very conversational, quite different to if you or I had the opportunity to
sit down.
Can we
learn a bit, I think, do you think, from Adam? Think we can learn a bit, hone our own interviewing style?
Well, I don't know. I don't know that we could, because it's a very different dynamic, isn't it? They are peers. Adam Blythe and Caleb Ewan are teammates, and not just teammates, but a lot of the year, Adam Blythe is going to be riding in service of Caleb Ewan, and so there is a sort of hierarchy there. The kind of, it's like a seesaw, isn't it? Because on the one hand, Adam Blythe is the more senior in terms of experience, but on the other hand, Caleb Ewan is the winner, the star, and will be, you know, relying on Adam Blythe to do work for him in races. But to hear the two of them talking together, and just, I think Caleb Ewan relaxed and opened up. You can almost hear in the first 5 or 10 minutes him, you know, thinking, oh, this is actually going to be all right. Maybe understanding that it's just a conversation and that the microphones just happen to be between them. And I found that really interesting, because I think it's a very different type of conversation than I would have had, say, sitting down to talk to Caleb Ewan.
Yeah, that was an interesting dimension to it for me as well, because that was the first interview that Adam did as part of this series. And I think originally we imagined that we wouldn't use the first one that he did first in the series. But actually, it was interesting and very timely with Milan-San Remo coming up. And I think he got off to a flyer. I look forward to the rest of the interviews in the series.
Well, who's next?
Luke Rowe, I believe, is coming next. But that's maybe to be confirmed. But certainly he's interviewed Luke Rowe. And that, again, is fascinating. They have a long history, those two going back 15 years or so. So that's fascinating too. But thank you once again to Adam. Thanks to Caleb Ewan as well for being interviewed. And I look forward to the rest of the series.
I do. One other point I just wanted to make was that when you hear Caleb Ewan and to an extent Adam talking, you realise just to what extent they have their own individual views of their own careers and the races and things that went on around them. You know, they're not doing the same sort of journalistic job of necessarily fact-checking who won this or who won that. They see a very thin tranche of the peloton and of the racing, and there's a sort of ease and charm to that. You know, the things that Caleb Ewan doesn't know about, he doesn't try to pretend that he's got a view on or whatever. It's quite a revealing little insight into how the minds of a one person in a bunch of 200 in a world tour of 400 operate.
And I'd love to know what happened to that Team Sky bike. If anybody knows, get in touch. If it's out there.
Yeah, but they could have been on Specialized, couldn't they, at some point? What a revelation.
Sliding doors. Anyway, that was just one little tidbit in many. Thanks once again. Thanks everybody for listening. I hope you tune in to the next one. Thank you, Lionel.
Thank you, Richard.
You have been listening to The Cycling Podcast. Subscribe to our newsletter at thecyclingpodcast.com to get all the latest news and special offers delivered straight to your inbox. This episode was edited and produced by Tom Wally.